The GAA Hour is sponsored by Paddy Power. For exclusive content from their GAA ambassadors and other high-profile contributors, check out news.paddypower.com.
I'm not finished yet. It took me a long time to get here.
Both parents have spoken with each other, and they regret what happened. They've had a frank discussion with each other, and they're both of them are keen to now focus on getting back their county jerseys.
But these fellas will get such a shit shock next Saturday evening that we'll put them back in their asses for 10 years.
Paul Flynn, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much.
How are you feeling? You're a week out. It was this day last week that you dropped the bombshell on everybody. Are you still, you're happy with the decision? Obviously, I'm sure a lot of thought went into it.
Yeah, no, look, I suppose when you make a call like that, it's not something you think of one day and say, right, let's go with this. I gave it a lot of thought. To be honest with you, like, it's been something that's been on my mind from the end of last season.
Right.
And I wasn't sure whether I was going to go back. And I felt that, you know, I played well last year, even though I didn't get probably, you know, as much game time as, obviously you want as a player. But when I did come on, I felt I was moving well. And that kind of was the key thing that made me go back for one more year to see if I could get a good league campaign. I went back in good nick. I really trained hard in December. I went back very fit. And I had hoped that that would kind of, you know, get me into the panel early in the league. And then it's up to you then to maintain that.
Yeah.
And I did. I started the first league game against Monaghan. Something nearly fell there on you. But but then after that, it was kind of, you know, it was hard. And I wasn't even playing that well in training. I was, you know, getting frustrated with myself. And you know, like, the body is taking its toll a little bit, you know. And
you're frustrated that you weren't able to get up and down the field like you used to? Or you're just not, you weren't kicking well? You know, what were you frustrated with?
The main thing, I think, is repeated sprintability. You know, being able to not just get up and down the pitch, but with impact, you know.
Right.
Getting back and making tackles rather than just getting back and covering space. Getting up and getting into position for good shots rather than just getting up there for the sake of getting up there. You know, and that's the difference. Making really strong runs off the shoulder after making a 50-yard burst back to get a tackle in and still be able to get onto the end of a move.
Yeah.
And that's the difficult thing, you know, and that's probably you got to do it, you know, the fact that I'm 32, but part of it as well is obviously maybe related to the fact that, you know, I've had a number of operations over the last number of years that take its toll on the body as well. That's all a part of it. Then when I played the second championship game with the club there last 2 weeks ago, I tweaked my hamstring.
Yeah, did you just tweak it? Because when I heard this, I was like, he's after pulling his hamstring now. He's after getting really thick because he's a competitor. And he's like, I'm done with this. I've tried so hard to get back right. And I was thinking maybe that might have been a knee-jerk reaction to that injury.
No, it wasn't. That was just a kind of a probably compound on top of the other things. It was my glute, actually. It was a tweak on my glute, which is directly related to my back. And, you know, it was probably just a sign that, you know, as I increase the intensity, that this is going to become a factor again, and I didn't really want that.
Yeah.
So it was part of the decision. You know, not being able to get to the standards that I set myself because of the back surgery and because of other factors, you know, was the main part of the decision as well.
And it's the 5 in a row thing. Like, I mean, straight away I was thinking, Jesus, hang on in there. Like, I mean, how? Because that's all the talk this year. But you would have no interest in just being in there with no chance of playing. Like, I mean, what does would the 5 in a row, 5 medals mean anything to you? Or was that a big kind of make the decision even harder, I suppose?
The funny thing about, like, with that, a lot of people, when they were asking them last year, when you're asking, you know, trusted people, you know, for their opinion on it about going back, they mentioned that, but that wasn't what was driving me going back. What was driving me was that I played quite well in the summer last year and that I wanted to see if I could get back up to that standard on a continual basis throughout the league and into the bringing it into the championship, and I just couldn't, was the answer. And so it was really that was what I was chasing, was that performance,
getting back
again
on the team.
And getting back into the starting team. Don't get me wrong, like, you know, like, the 5 in a row is you know, are the potential for a 5 in a row, let's be honest. You know, you kind of take, you, people are saying, oh, what about the 5 in a row? So there's a long way to go before,
but you are on the 5 in a row. It's like you're on a hat trick, you're on it. Like,
yeah,
you know what I mean,
you can go for it, but the way I look at it is, like, I'll still I wouldn't have valued it as much if I didn't feel I was making a meaningful impact to the whole panel, and that's just the way I'm built. And then the other thing is, I will feel that I've played a part in it because, you know, I've been involved in four of them. Whereas, you know, some guys in that panel who, yes, they'd be on the team that potentially can go for five, but they may not be in there for the first one. Do you know that kind of way? But look, it was really about kind of, you know, what drives you, what makes you tick. And when I couldn't really, when I didn't feel I was going to be able to add to the team in that way, like, you know, for me, it was an easier decision than most people thought.
Right, OK. It did come as a surprise to most people. Let's go back to the start then. So you were taken off at halftime on your debut. So it didn't go smooth sailing. And I actually didn't realise that until I read it. It was Tomás O'Shea as well was taken off at halftime in his debut. So anyone that gets taken off on their debut at halftime, that's not the end of the world, right? So, like, I mean, what happened that day? Like, would you put too much pressure on yourself? I know you're a big Dublin fan and being on the hill and everything, watching the team before you made your debut. So,
yeah.
What did you put that down to?
I didn't, like, I mean, naivety, really, like, you know, and just, like, this was, like, back when there was 80,000 people at the first game in Leinster, and it was against Westmeath, and Austin Healy was the player I was marking. I think it was Austin Healy. Yeah, anyway. And he was...
No, not Austin. Damien Healy.
Damien Healy. Great player. Absolutely phenomenal player. And probably... and he was old, he was into his 30s when I was, you know, so I was feeling like I'm going to run him, you know, and that was my
thing. He had a good
thing.
Engine.
And he had some engine. And he ran me and he kicked 2 points, I think, in the first half. And he played like, but that season he was phenomenal and like he was a great player. But I was really naive to think that I was going to be able to go out there and just run him when he was a seasoned campaigner. Like there were balls going straight to me and, you know, I was just. Like emotionally hijacked, I was all over the shop. I didn't know where I was, and I couldn't catch the ball or anything. So, yeah, it was a pretty straightforward decision for Pillar. Now, in fairness, to take me off, but I think things like that they kind of build your character a little bit too. You know,
yeah, it didn't come easy. Then you know, at the start, you know, you often see Kieran Kilkenny, Jack McCaffrey. It just happened for those lads. You know what I mean? But like, it doesn't happen like that for everyone. Some fellas have to grow into it, I suppose.
Yeah, and that was the same all through the whole season. In 2008, you know, and I didn't play that much after that. I got a few kind of bit roles, but then it was 9 when Pat came in that I got a real chance at it, you know. So
And that was in 9. You got a real chance under Pat, and maybe that was the start of Learwig's year, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So like, I mean, it turned out into a bit of a disaster, and came back in 10. And he came back with a little bit more of a defensive game plan then. So things were starting to change for Dublin tactically, I suppose.
Yeah, they were. But like, I remember before Pat came in that he, like into September, when you're trying to say to yourself, I haven't had a good year. There's a potential this manager's going to come in and have no interest in me at all, you know, and you might not have an inter-county career, never mind a good one. And but he rang me here before I even started, saying that, you know, really interested in working with me, wanted to see me in the half forward line, wanted to work with me to build up my skills, to use the raw talent that you had and the determination and work rate and to build the other parts of the game. And that kind of gave me real confidence going into that season. And I had a good season in 9, but you know, it was just building. But it was 10, and that was the year when we built on a defensive organisation and structure. The first thing, I think, in the first four league games we won that year, and we didn't get to the league final or anything like that, but we had a really good campaign. And then and we were beaten in the championship by Cork in the semi-final, which we should have won.
We were
around 8 points up that game. But then it was, you know, and I didn't have a great year in 10. I came in and out of the panel. I actually started against Meath when they scored 5 goals against us.
Yeah.
And then we went into...
You played the Leinster Championship, and then against Tip you were taken off that year, was it? And didn't get back in again.
No, I came on as a sub. Probably the biggest impact I had in that season was I took a horrendous shot on my right foot against Tyrone and hit the crossbar, and O'Gara was on the end of it to score the goal. That kind of, you know, was the catalyst for our performance that year. But because that was a big win for us, beating Tyrone. They were a team that we would have benchmarked ourselves against, and you know, they were phenomenal, you know, phenomenally successful team. So we were kind of after them. They gave us a bad beating in 08. Kerry had given us one in 09, and then we went into 10. We got that was a big win, big monkey off our back.
Yeah, and you had a good performance against Cork then, who won the All-Ireland, so you had something to build on. And then so that's the first 3 years, like, I mean, and it was a start to your career. Like, you were on, you were off, you had some bad performances, you paid the price for it, you were off the team. And then between 10 and 11, you go on a run of 4 years with All Stars in a row. Did anything change between 10 and 11, or was it maybe the system, the team getting better, a lot of combination of things?
I think there was a couple of things, yeah. Like, I suppose you probably grow in confidence a little bit, and you kind of find your place in even just a squad, you know, your own identity in the squad, where you're probably looking maybe for the first couple of years up at guys who are there years and they were role models of yours, and you're kind of a little bit in awe, where you wake up into that and you kind of grow into the role. And then as well as that, I was back in DCU, I was studying, I was really concentrating on my game, and that kind of built into it too, because I was playing Sigerson Cup with different players, and you're learning different things, different coaches,
right?
But that all builds up into it, and yet also then I had more time to be able to concentrate on my game and to work on the areas that needed to be worked on.
Right, and like even Sigerson for me was kind of like you're playing against these players from other counties, and for some reason in your head you always think they're doing it better in another county, and then you realise you're playing against them and you're as easily as good as them, you know, some reason that just in your own head maybe gives you that little bit more confidence that you're definitely up there with those good players from other counties
big time. And and it's a really competitive competition, and it's like something that in the team that we had in DCU, like, you know, a lot of the Dublin lads that were part of the squad now were there, like with Paddy Andrews, Dean Rock, Johnny Cooper, and in particular Dean Rock and Johnny Cooper weren't getting like a look in with Dublin at the time, but they were phenomenal. They were probably the best two players in the DCU team, so you know, like, I think that's the beauty of college football, is that you always have guys who are, you know, excellent in that game and in them conditions, and but don't necessarily bring that into the inter-county setup straight away, and it takes time. So you do learn a lot from that competition. I think it's a great competition.
Yeah, no, it definitely is. So you played a lot of your underage football in defence actually, and midfield. So wing forward in the modern game and a target for clucks and kickouts. It was just set up for you. You know what I mean? In 2011, to go on that run, you were guaranteed possession in games. You know, you weren't dependent on anybody else to get you the ball. You were there as a, you know, one of the main targets for Cluxton's kickouts.
You did your homework with me being a defender, but I was full back, I was centre back.
I couldn't believe that when I saw that, full back. And you ended up full back in one of the All-Irelands there 1 year too.
Against Mayo,
yeah.
But the kickouts was always one of my strengths growing up, like, you know, my hands. And and then when we kind of started adopting that kickout style with Stephen, and I was just, you know, it really worked. But like, you know, and it's not as easy now to get that space in half forward, you know, because people are more kind of aware of it, you know.
The
zonal defence kind of really kind of mitigates against that. But again, at the same time, at that period of time, I remember even in 2011, that All-Ireland final, Kerry were very aware of it, and I didn't get as many. Now I had a hamstring injury going into it, so I wasn't able to make them long runs. But Kerry were aware of it, and they dropped two players into the zone. So they tried to kind of just to stop that impact, because that was one where we used to build a lot of our attacking plays from, which would get it out to the pockets and then, you know, transition quickly. So, but you know, that did get you into a game. And ball winning your own ball still is critically important to any inter-county player.
For your own confidence, you're like, I don't need someone to pass me the ball, I'm going to win my own ball from these kickouts. You know, yeah. I think that's a great thing. But I was wondering, because in the last maybe 2 years, Cluxton, maybe even 3 years, Dublin have reverted to a much more possession based game, and Cluxton's not as adventurous with his kickouts. He'd tap it to Johnny Cooper if it's there, you know what I mean, rather than maybe go for those pockets. And there's obviously reasons for that, because teams are dropping players into it. So, like, I mean, would you find yourself in a game having to adapt, going, right, well, that's, I'm not getting my guaranteed possessions now. Now I have to try and mix it up a little bit and, you know, get on the ball in a different way.
Yeah, and it probably fed into people not being involved in games as much, you know, and having an impact on your own performance, because that was a strength of mine. And then you're trying to adapt, and, you know, when you're getting man, like, as well as that in the early doors, in 11 and 12, I very seldom got man marked. You know, you just have a kind of a half back who would, you know, be attacking, or they would be there, but they wouldn't be man marking you. And then, like, more recently, like, all six forwards get man marked, and then they have a sweeper who will kind of cover into the space or whatever like that. And that was a different dynamic as well, because you really have to work hard to get on the ball, where it was that a bit easier, prior to that. So yeah, no, that's how the game evolves, and that's, it'll continue to evolve going into the future as well.
Yeah, is it as enjoyable the game now where it's kind of disorganised and you're floating around, you're getting a hand pass? Like, I mean, you can't really do anything with that hand pass. You just have to hand pass it off. Whereas your natural game would be to give it inside, or, you know, or do some. You always want to do something on the ball. Is it difficult to kind of come to terms with the fact that I'm getting the ball here now and I'm probably just going to pass it off backwards and then just run around somewhere else? Yes. You know,
I said there recently, like in 2014 was a really enjoyable year for me because we played that, like what you were saying.
You were flying it that year, yeah.
But we were playing really good, really expansive football where we did take risks. We kicked the ball a lot. Of course, we made mistakes, but we always backed ourselves that we'd win the ball back and then go on the attack again. And we didn't tend to play with a sweeper. We went man-to-man, and that was really enjoyable, obviously, like, you know. And obviously, for myself, you're right, I would have always liked to get the ball and try kick. I remember, you know, when Alan was playing centre forward and I was winning them kickouts, like the amount of times that I just catch it and kick it up to where I was, you know. So
and Alan would be breaking across.
And Alan would be there. And, you know, we had such a good relationship. And then when he left, and I might have been a little bit closer to goal, the amount of ball I kicked to Bernard was like, you know, and I look back now on games and I'm saying, that's like, you know, it's crazy how much we used to look for one, or I used to look for him, and it wasn't because I was thinking it. It was that relationship there, and that happens when you play with guys, you know, through the years. You just know what runs they're going to make. He knows, you know, a good forward will know that if I'm going to turn on my right foot, I'm going to look to kick it. I'm not a ball carrier, really. I'm a guy who likes to use the boot, and
yeah.
So he'd be clever enough to be able to feed off that. And Alan was similar, like, but now the game has changed a bit where, you know, you might be looking up and there's a sweeper there in front of you, so you have to be a little bit more clever about your ball usage. But you know, that's just part and parcel, I believe, of, and I know, you know, you have views on this, but I think it's part and parcel of how the game is going to evolve. And
It's not as good to watch. Like, I mean, and I play a little bit of intermediate and stuff, and I don't think it's as good to play.
Football,
and the Masters, yeah. Losing to Dublin again, livid. But it's not as good to play either. I don't care. But then again, maybe, like, sometimes we complain about players that played in the 70s and 80s and how they have a romantic view of when they played. And maybe I'm like that with the 2000s, for example. And now just football's different and you have to stop whinging about when you play it, you know?
Yeah, I think there is an element to that. But, like, there's also an element where, like, when I think we're in a bit of a transitionary period. I always felt that in 14, if we had have won that All-Ireland, maybe a lot of teams might have replicated that man-to-man style.
Yeah.
And I still kind of carry a bit of hope that will be the case, that maybe not a full, you know, full court press, because there was a bit of a naivety to that, but a more attacking and expansive style of football. Because if you look at, and I often kind of compare it to different sports, but if you look at the Premiership at the moment, where you've got Liverpool and Man City, and they're playing a very high press style of football.
Yeah.
I've never been as, even though I'm a Manchester United fan, and it hurts me to say that them two teams are doing well, you're looking at them saying they play a really attractive style of football.
Yeah.
But that wasn't always the case in the Premiership, and even over the last number of years, that's evolved. I hated watching, like, the Barcelona playing the tippy-tap football. And so, again, I suppose what I'm trying to say is I think that Gaelic football will evolve and that teams will, you know, sitting men back, you know, hasn't won that many All-Irelands. And hopefully if teams can, you know, win it by having an expansive attacking style of football, that maybe others might follow suit.
Yeah, you do, like, I suppose I'd say the 2017, I want to talk to you about two Donegal games, because I think they shaped a lot of your career and Dublin's tactics and evolution. But I suppose it came to like a crescendo against Tyrone in 2017. That must have been a very satisfying win, even though, like, you blew away a team that people thought you were going to have a lot of problems with really calculated, you know, professional demolition job, not taking the ball into the tackle, moving it around, taking them out of their zones. That was almost a perfect performance, really, from Dublin, was it?
Yeah, we played really, really well that day, in fairness. You know, we used the ball really well, and we probably had got a good opportunity to see them in really competitive games throughout that season. So, like, they had some tough games in Ulster that year, and we got to see how they were going to set up, and then we just spent a lot of time kind of analysing how we could break it down. And, you know, we did it really well that day. I didn't start that game, but I came on, and I, you know, And I scored 3 points when I came on as a sub. And I remember saying, like, I wasn't even playing that well that year, but I got into the game. But it was just because there was a wave of, we were in the zone. And that was that feeling, like, you know, you play games where things are just going really well for you and they're not going well for the opposition. And it was like last night with Liverpool and Barcelona. You could see that they were rattled last night, even Messi. And in that game, we were just all on it. And you could feel that buzz and energy when I came into the team that day. And when it's like that, sometimes it can be hard to stop that momentum.
Yeah, no, and you had lads posted in positions out really wide and you were running across. It looked like there was a lot of coaching. And Jason Sherlock got a lot of the credit for that. I'm not sure, you know, whether it was his influence, but there's definitely some basketball influence with the loop in runs. And it just looked like just a perfectly coached team. And I thought that was, after that hammering, that the defensive systems were kind of, you know, they would have to change because it's been figured out now. And even Leash against Carlo were copying your tactics that day, you know, and maybe that result has helped move the game on from what we've seen maybe this year.
Well, like, if you just take that Tyrone team, like, they've evolved their game something fierce since that game.
Yeah.
And they've been doing really well. And, like, I know last year they were beaten, but even this year they bet Dublin. And if you looked at the way they played this year in the league versus the way they played maybe in that game, it's like completely changed and evolved. And a credit to them for building on that year on year. I'm really interested to see how they kind of come out of the traps this year, because they were kicking the ball a hell of a lot more.
Like, I mean, the thing about your full back line likes to mark from the front, and nobody ever put manners on them because they were always running it through the hands. Do you know, now, whereas now they're kicking it in. Now, I'm sure in the Dublin dressing room, they're like having to rethink maybe. You know, they're just being asked more questions. Tyrone did in Croke Park, and it's like we've been saying on the podcast, why don't more teams do that? Like, Mayo are the only team that would ask your full back line questions with good direct ball, and they are the ones that did well against you. But then all the other teams try to do it a different way, which clearly didn't work.
I think you need to be flexible. I think that's the thing now in modern football, is that if you have one system and you play it throughout the whole year,
you'll be found out.
People know what you're going to do and they prepare for it. Whereas if you can adapt in game and, you know, look at what the opposition are doing and try and find holes in it, that's what the good teams are trying to do anyway.
Yeah. So Donegal 2011, that must have been the weirdest game ever to play, because this was the first time we all actually saw it's so extreme, where I was actually on the hill that day, and you want to hear what was being said up there. Nobody knew what was going on. There was just booze, and it was like, we're used to it now, but that day, like, I'm sure you weren't expecting the extreme version of what you got that day.
No, not at all. It was fascinating, like the way the game kind of evolved, and, you know, that it was so defensive. And, you know, in many ways, like, you know, in some games you feel this real energy from the opposition and you feel this energy from the fans that's kind of feel it's going against you. You know, you often get it when you're playing against Mayo. They tend to have really, really strong support there. But that day, you could feel it with Donegal. It was like, I felt like we were in Ballybuffet or something like that.
Really?
You know, they had great support there. And they rattled us, like, you know, in the first half. And and I remember, I think it was just directly after half time where McFadden had a goal opportunity and it went over the bar. But if that went in, like, it would have been a very difficult role for us to get back into that game, you know?
Because he continued to kick it that day, didn't you? Because you just weren't expecting it. You were trying to get to Bernard. Remember Ger Brennan kicking a lot of ball away, going, like, we know now that that's stupid. Like, 9 years later, you're like, what were you doing? But back then, it was like, how do we deal with what they're doing?
Yeah, like, and it was like, it wasn't as if, you know, we had an alternative. That was our game plan, you know? And that's what I was saying to you earlier on, where if that is the case, and that you can't evolve in games or you can't adapt in a game, that's when a team can find you out. But that day, like, they had their homework done, and, you know, we didn't, but we still at half time and being able to come in then, we did get over the line, which was probably more about will than determination than really about kind of tactically kind of finding holes in it, you know. So
yeah, and then 14, you played them again, you beat them obviously in 11 and 14. It was kind of like you were on such a high. You were defending All-Ireland champions. You were blowing teams away. Jim Gavin, in all his interviews, was asked about the brilliant football you're playing, and he was talking about how this has been passed down from generation. This is how teams he played on. And you almost, like, telegraphed, because he hammered Monaghan with this huge press, you know, it was like you're saying there that your tactics were obvious in that you were going all out and you didn't cover your defence, and Jim McGuinness kind of copped on to that. That must have been a huge low point, because it was maybe a little bit embarrassing. I think it was a bit embarrassing because you'd been going so well, and the manner of probably the second half, or even after the first 25 minutes.
Yeah, like I've said, like this was probably, I felt that was the year I was talking about. Like we were playing brilliant football all year that year, and you know, but we were probably a bit one dimensional. We were going all out attack. We were playing man to man. We had no sweeper, and we got found out, right? But like in that first 25 minutes, we dominated them, and we pinned them back, and we'd, you know, we'd identified kicking. Long range shooting, with the low work of it for the year. Obviously, they're lower percentage shots, but at the same time, you know, we were able to back ourselves. But we also had goal opportunities.
Yeah, and Connolly had a big one, didn't he?
Yeah. I think we had another one where a hand pass just went behind a man. I can't remember who it was. But if one of those went in, I always say that we would have went clear. I don't think we wouldn't turn back, because we probably would have deployed some sort of you know, cover or sweeper of some kind, you know, because we were 7 or 8 points ahead. But at the same time, then we just got sucker punched, and they were so clinical then as well, and they just kind of kept getting us on the counter attack, and we just didn't know what to do about it. And yeah, really difficult loss for me personally. I felt that, like, I took that loss really badly, and you know, I remember at the time saying that, like, I felt like I had to grieve that loss to a certain extent, because, you know, I felt we were on the cusp of something really special, and, you know, it didn't materialise, which was really disappointing. But
right. Well, without that loss, you probably wouldn't have got more street smart. You know what I mean? You haven't been caught since, I suppose, you know? So, yeah. Like, I mean, some good came out of it. Oh, Keane O'Sullivan's a sweeper, and you're a lot smarter on the field now, I suppose.
Yeah, no. We learned a lot from that game, but at the same time, when you're in the middle of it, you can't see that, like, yeah. You know. And but you only learn from, you know, when you get the time to reflect, and you get the time to, you know, think about, you know, how we can improve, I suppose. But but no, at the time you couldn't see the wood from the trees, I suppose, you know?
Yeah. So when you're talking about your wing forward play, how would it have evolved? Like, I mean, in 2011, like, you're talking about getting back to making a lot of tackles, and I always noticed, even though I didn't like doing that at wing forward, you'd lose your man by doing that. So suddenly then you're free, he's not going to follow you if you're following a man, then you have the engine to be able to do that and get up the other end of the field and score. Like, you have to process what your role is in the team in your own mind kind of first, don't you?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, I would have, you try to shape your game off people who've gone before you, you know, and Paul Galvin was a brilliant number 10, Doher. And there was, and Danny Hughes from Down actually played really well too. And
yeah.
When you are that bit reckless when the opposition have the ball, you do, you know, you're very hard to mark. You know, yeah. You could be anywhere. And that was always the way that I kind of would base. And even further down, when you start to get man marked, when teams identify you as somebody who could be playing, who would play in a key link role, I always felt that the way to get away from them was
to work
hard,
yeah.
Or to work, you know. And, you know, there was a couple of times when you never get man marked is, you know, on their kickouts, for instance. You know, you identify that as saying, right, he's not marking me now, let me go and hunt down this ball and get on it and start getting into the game. So but yeah, no, it kind of evolved from initially just being that kind of, I would say, you know, doing a lot of the donkey work, really. And then you kind of say, hold on, you layer on then bit by bit. You start saying, right, I want to chip in with 2 scores a game. You want to get, you know, good passes into the full forward line. You want to not just be winning kickouts, but you want to be really impacting on the offensive structure as well. So
yeah, but you see, your engine enabled you to do that, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You could do all that work and get back up, and I suppose you never feel as confident as when you're flying fit. And I suppose in those 4 years you just knew, I can do all that work, I can get back up, and I can affect the game in an offensive capacity as well, which must have been a lovely place to be in, knowing that your body would allow you to do that.
Yeah, and I always had this thing in my head that, like, you know, even if I get tightly marshalled for 40 minutes, I always felt that no one would live with me for 70.
I'd wear him down. Ross Munnelly used to be like that too. They won't, because he used to be flying fit. They will not stay with me all day if I continuously make these runs.
Yeah, and I had that in my head for years, you know. And I actually still said it to some other players, like, going forward. I was like, you know, you will get man marked in games if you're seen as a key player. So, you know, just make sure that you, and believe in the fact that, you know, it's a long game, and especially as an inside forward, sometimes, you know, that can be difficult. But, you know, Bernard, I always felt, was so good at that, is that if he was out of the game for a long period, you know, he knew, he had to wear it all to know that all I need is one chance here and I'm going to rattle the back of the net. And he did it in so many games. And, you know, I always try to keep that kind of mindset as well, that you might clip 2 or 3 points in the last 25 minutes of a game after kind of working hard and doing all that kind of, you know, unseen work that actually became very seen. Like, it became, you know, people were interested in that forward role,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, so. Yeah. Did you see, notice a difference in that? Suddenly your work was being highlighted rather than you're just running around and people are not. Because all the whole way up along, wing forwards wanted 2 or 3 points. And outside, if you're not getting them, what are you doing there? But then it completely changed. And, you know, all the work that you're doing is suddenly becomes massively important to the team.
Yeah. And that, and like, but like, when I started in that position, like, there were the 2 half forwards who were the workers, and everyone else in the forward line didn't really work that much, you know. They did work, but like passively more than, yeah. Like nowadays the 6 forwards have to do the same level, if not more work, than, you know, yeah. I would be doing.
Actually, sorry to cut you off, can I ask you a question on that? Because I remember Alan Brogan telling me the Pillar used to give him a pass that if his man went up, follow him so far but pawn him off because we want you fresh, right? Well, that made sense to me as well, because like, why, when you've got like a player of the year standard player, why do you want him wrecking himself chasing when someone else can do it? And now I notice we talk about this on the podcast all the time. Every forward tracks his man, and we think it's because Dublin do it, you know, and everyone copies the All-Ireland champions. Because I see the likes of Jamie Clark, and he might have to his cornerback might take off and he takes off with him. So you've got Jamie Clark, like one of the most skillful players, now wrecked. And that's exactly what the, no disrespect to the cornerback, to a lesser ability, you know, a player wants. He wants to drag him out. Why do they follow instead? Because there's enough men around that middle third, or is there a tactical reason why everybody follows their man, even the real scoring forwards, and wasting energy? Like, you wouldn't see Messi chasing someone to, you know, to lose his energy. I don't know why in GEA it seems to be this, you're not working hard enough for me if you're all not following your men.
Yeah, I think there's a balance somewhere in the middle whereby, you know, if there's a threat to the run that's being made, you have to honour it. And he could create an overlap, he could make a run that distracts, you know, potentially your sweeper, you know. So it's not as straightforward as saying you can let him off and I'm going to hang tough here for the ball that's going to be turned over, because, you know, in the game right now, the ball can be turned over less and it might end up in a score, so we'll have time to get back. Where,
right, yeah.
You know, maybe back a couple of years back, you know, there might be a kick pass, it might turn over really quickly and then you're free.
And you put manners on him. That doesn't really happen now, does it not?
It less so, you know. Yeah. So, it is a point well made. I remember having to honour runs and there were halfbacks and they were just running into the far corner and they were only doing it just to get, you know, me out of position.
Yeah.
And that, you know, you do question it at the time. You're saying, why am I making this run? I know I'm going to be I'm going to lack a bit of juice going forward the other way now when the next play comes along. But that's why the levels of fitness now are just, you know, phenomenal, you know, and lads will be covering, you know, well above 10k a game and stuff like that. So.
Yeah. And have you been checking your stats? Have your stats been have been falling? Is that some reason why you were talking about your ability to get those high intensity sprints back up the field? Is that all monitored that you'd notice your numbers getting worse? Or,
well, because I wouldn't know the numbers from back when I was doing all right. To be able to compare. But what I just know is that I wasn't getting back up to make.
Felt it yourself.
Yeah.
Okay. Come here, another one I wanted to ask you. Oh yeah, your kicking technique. You kind of give Michael Murphy a bit of credit for that, because he's obviously got a sensational kicking technique, and you did a lot of work together at DCU. You lived together, and practice makes perfect, I suppose. So, like, I mean, was that something you figured out yourself, or was something he helped you with? Or, like, I often think kicking, I don't know, like, I was never the best kicker in the world. I don't know if somebody gave me advice who would make me a better kicker. I know you are a good kicker, so, you know.
I'd say I worked hard on it.
Really?
Wasn't someone who, you know, growing up, like, I wouldn't have kicked 3 or 4 points in underage games. It was erratic, you know, and I think I got a couple of key interventions. One was with Michael and getting a chance to kick with him, you know, and just kick. Well, part of it was the fact that I was kicking more because I was going out doing just kicking sessions. But then the other part of it was that you're just like listening, you're watching the style, and he's got a real nonchalant kind of like relaxed style.
He does, yeah.
Where I was like, you know, I probably have to work in at 100% to get the ball back, and then I'm trying to kick it at 100%, and you know, Paul Clark, you know, great coach as well, all said to me from a really young age, like, you know, yeah, work hard at 100% to get the ball. When you have it, then you need to go back down to around 80% because you'll get the good strikes then. And as well as that, I used to do sessions one on one. Myself, Pat Gilroy, and Bernard. Bernard, like, as well as that, and that was really breaking it down into kind of a three stages of a kick. Whereas one was compose yourself, the second was concentrate on getting a good strike, and the third was make sure you follow through. And I used to like do, I had a kicking routine that I still did and I'll still do when I, you know, doing a bit of kicking practice, is that, like, you know, breaking down into one, compose, two, strike, three, follow through, and not care where the ball ends up. But, like, you know, 9 times out of 10 when you get the good strike and follow through, they will end up going over the bar. And so you know, there is a lot of work you can do with that. And even you can compare that to golf, where you look at guys, you know, and you know, a nice smooth swing, and they make good contact and the ball goes so far, and you're like saying, you know, he's a small guy, how is he hitting it so far? But it's all about the strike, you know. So,
yeah, you got very good at kicking them from your bad side, like wrapping them back around that way. Is that something you would have practiced on? Most of your points nearly come from there, am I right? That's just from memory now. You know, maybe it's just whatever side you're coming off someone's shoulder, but you seem to be wrapping them around on your back, which is technically a more difficult kick.
Yeah, the lads used to like call it my sweet spot in training, because I'd literally get 30 balls from that spot and I wouldn't go anywhere else. I always had this thing in my head that the other side is easier, so I could this is the hardest kick, so get this right and the rest of them will be easier. But if you think about it, like, if you can, a lot of good forwards can do that that shot. But there's more space out there. If you go in the other side, if you're cutting in, there's always going to be men in there. Whereas you're going out, you're going away from the players. So, you know, that's why I always went after it. And if you can just get the angles right, you know, I always felt anywhere around that space, I'd always back myself. So, again, it's just down to really practice and, you know.
Yeah, because Conor McManus gets some outrageous points from that side, and I didn't really think about that because he's obviously not running into the crowd. He's trying to, like, usually when you go out that side, you're not going to be, obviously there's nobody out there because there's no one outside there, but like people are kind of like, he's out there, we'll kind of let him shoot.
Yeah, there is a little bit of that. Yeah. Like, you know, they don't want you cutting inside. They're always maybe fearful of the chances you might get in a goal or an easier score. But I always felt that if you go out that way, you know, you're going to get more shots. So,
yeah. What about Jim Gavin's? He's pretty cutthroat. The only one I've seen ever turn around when he's kind of out of the team is Paddy Andrews. And I don't know, he did it this year. You know, last year I thought Paddy was completely out of the reckoning, and then this year he came back into the team. Do you feel the writing's on the wall with Jim sometimes when you get a little bit older? And we know, and this is not a criticism of Jim Gavin, this is why you keep winning All-Irelands, is that he's ruthless and he moves lads on and new lads come in and they have that hunger. Is there ever a kind of thing goes through your head, Jesus, I'm being shipped out here? Or, you know, does that go through your head?
No, I think there's, like, you could probably, in fairness to Jim, he'll play. If you're playing well enough, he'll play. And
right.
That's, like, you know, and that's been always part of his kind of thinking process, and he's always highlighted that to players. But, you know, at the same time, like, there's some phenomenally good young players coming through, you know. So you can, you know, as a guy who's kind of just retired, who's looking back, he can say, oh yeah, sure, I should have started every game. But at the same time, there's some like really talented young footballers in Dublin at the moment, and you know, and they're hungry and they're committed, and you know, and they've got time, you know. Maybe some of them are students as well, so they're really investing into their own performance in the game. So, you know, I think if you're playing well enough, he'll pick you.
So it's going off training, it's not going off age profiles, it's just going off who's going well in training, and that's all.
It's not going off age profile, but it's going off performance. But you need, like, you know, you need to be playing well in league, then he'll build that into the championship, and then, you know, but, like, you know, maybe training does come into it, but more so around the games that have happened throughout the course of the year.
Right, because Kilkenny were famous for really intense kind of in-house games, and ye have a squad that could pick, you know, your second team would be Leinster champions. And it was, you know, I'm sure those games are pretty intense, are they?
They're great games, you know, and that's why I was saying, like, someone asked me there recently, you know, I can't remember, like, who's one of your fiercest competitors? And, like, you know, I was saying, you know, Jamesy and Jack, because... You're going against them once a week, you know what I mean? And whereas you might play a guy, another guy, once a year, and you know, you'd be sick at the sight of, you know, of them lads, because, you know, Jack has such speed, and James is as hard as nails, and when he starts going, it's very hard to catch. And so like them games are, you know, they lend themselves to, you know, an environment that, you know, players will, you know, have to push themselves very, very hard. And but that's no different. All squads up and down the country have really competitive games.
Yeah, no, true. Come here, another couple of ones. Do you ever feel sorry for Mayo at all?
After
beating them, like, I know you're competitors and I know whatever, but, like, I mean, especially the second one when Lee Keegan got that goal, like, he obviously won it. And maybe this is just a stupid question, would you ever stop and think, Jesus, you kind of feel a little bit bad for them? No.
Yeah, the utmost respect for that team. You know, I remember, funny story, when I was going All Ireland final in 2017, I had family members saying to me, you wouldn't begrudge Mayo with anyway, would you? And I was saying, like, I'm preparing here for, you know, All Ireland final, and you're saying this to me. So, but, like, you know, I did feel like in 18, like, you missed the buzz around Mayo, because they bring such, you know, you know, obviously the way they play is so exciting to watch, but also their fans are, you know,
yeah,
they're off the charts with regards to the commitment and all that. So, you know, absolutely utmost respect for them, but, like, when you're in the middle of it, you can only focus on yourself.
Ah, yeah, obviously, but Mayo, I'm talking well after the game, like, you know. I think it's your, but you've mentioned fans twice now, Mayo fans and Donegal fans, and Mayo fans, I always say, in Croke Park, and I've been on record for saying, stop complaining about Dublin support and go and support your team and take that advantage, because it is an advantage to Dublin having most of the fans in Croke Park. And Mayo take that away from you. They give it 50-50. You know, the noise-wise, it would be 50-50. And that has an effect probably on the game. Whereas Galway went up in the All-Ireland semi-final last year, there's feck all of them there. You know, do you think counties are selling their team short by not going up there? Because obviously the roar of the crowd has a huge bearing on giving you a lift, and also kind of having that demoralising effect when it's going against you.
Yeah, and, like, even sometimes, like, you know, there might be a lot more Dublin fans there, and just, it's just the way, I just always remember Mayo and Donegal fans to be really, really passionate and loud in games, you know. And but yeah, no, I do think it's important. That's where we're, you know, obviously the provincial games, or the games being played in provincial stands, like, you know, add to that buzz, you know, because whether you're playing with Dublin or whatever, you know, there is always that more of a balance of the crowds, and it's a lot more intimate. So you kind of get, the fans have an impact on it then. Where in Croke Park, unless there's 80,000 people there, the fans probably don't make that much of a difference, because it just, there's an echo, it doesn't feel as as in your face. Whereas, you know, when it's Boy Donegal game and the Mayo game come to mind, it's because it was 80,000 people there. And it was, when there is 80,000 people there, it's like a coliseum in there. It's like, you know, so warm, you know, you can't communicate with your teammates. Any wave of a momentum from the opposition fans is amplified, and that kind of, you know, builds on that. So
yeah,
but that would be the same in a provincial ground if there was only 20,000 people there and it was full. So that's why, you know, the hurling, for instance, last year, I always felt was so successful, because they were in provincial grounds, and all the games in the qualifiers predominantly were, and they were full, and then there's an excitement to the games, you know. So
yeah,
I think it adds to it.
It does make a difference. So I remember the Leinster final in 07 playing Dublin, and it was a full house as well, and I was shouting at the centre forward and Paul Lawler, and he couldn't hear me.
Yeah.
And I was only like 20 metres away from him on the wing. And I'm just wondering, like, when things are going at fever pitch against Mayo, you know, Lee Keegan scored that goal, like, are you trying to talk to each other? Like, how, you'd gotten to the point where you, I didn't think you'd pull that game out of it. I thought when Mayo got that goal that they would win it, because the whole weight of history was behind them, the whole country was behind them, and you were just like ruthless killers, that James McCarthy just comes up and kicks a pint, and it's like, this fairy tale isn't happening today, you know, like, I mean, yeah. And how do you communicate with each other? How do you calm things down when things are going crazy in a game like that?
Yeah, like, it's really difficult thing to do, you know. Momentum in games is so powerful, and but one, probably, if you it's all down to your preparation. And, you know, you have to have kind of, you know, in your mind that there are going to be phases in the game where a team gets, you know, a purple patch, or they are going to get a really big play. And it's what you do next. And you're trying your best to get a good kick out to start it off, get possession, kill their momentum, get a good transition into the forwards, and then try and kind of, you know, all you want to really do is you want to get yourself into position to get a shot. And if you can get a shot, then, you know, you can set yourself up from there. But it's when they get a big score and then they win the following kick out that you're kind of, the momentum
Cluxton
builds.
Is so important with that, isn't he? That he's ice cold, isn't he? He's just able to just make the right decision and not panic really in that situation, and then it can all probably start from there.
Yeah, Stephen's phenomenal. He's been like probably one of the most influential players that I've played with. You know, there's always a couple that come to mind, but he's always one because, you know, his, you know, that calmness, and it comes from his preparation. Like, you know, you would have seen bits of it as well when you were playing with him, that he's just so diligent in his preparation. It's frightening. And
he wanted to play in the forwards when I was with Parnell.
I'd say he would have been good there too. You know,
he was all right. He wasn't too bad. But that's the thing. Did you have signals with him, or was it eye contact, or was it the minute you moved? I'm not asking for the signals if there was, or was it just you had to make a movement and he's going to hit that, you know what I mean, where you're moving into?
Yeah, look, there's different setups, there's different movements, there's, you know, and some of it's just down to understanding, you know, where, you know, guys have a preferred type of run, but you work on it. Like, you have to work on your kickouts, and every team does. It's a really important part of, you know, today's game, and winning possession and building your offensive kind of platform from there. So absolutely, you see all the top teams now are going after their kickouts and you know, using it as a platform.
It used to be back in my day, Fergal Byrne would rub his chest. I'm sure it's got more sophisticated.
You'd be surprised, that could be still.
Finish up here. I want to talk to you about the perception of Dublin and whether you're kind of aware of it or whether you think it's fair. And I think it's stemming from maybe Jim Gavin not selling the famous kind of picture of Jim Gavin not even smiling after you win at beating Mayo in that crazy game, the media policy, maybe in the last 2 years there's accusations that you've been a little bit robotic in your play. I don't blame Dublin for that at all. That's in response to how other teams play against you. Are you aware that there's a perception of this kind of joyless Dublin, maybe, or controlled media kind of policy? Are you aware of that perception that's out there?
Like, I suppose when you're in the camp, like, you keep as much noise out as possible, you know, that kind of way. And it doesn't mean you don't do media. It just means that you just don't listen to, you know, what's being said and stuff like that. And I think it's an unfair kind of opinion on that group, because I know them, like, you know, so well. And there's some really, really interesting characters on that team. Brilliant, brilliant people. And, you know, I suppose it's like any county team. Like, you see it, you look at it, people see a Dublin jersey, a blue jersey, and they see, what I always say is, like, they see this uniformity amongst the whole team because they're wearing the same jersey, right? But, like, they couldn't be further from the truth. There's such diversity in that group. It's frightening. And, you know, I was only saying, like, there to somebody, Malachy Clerkin did a great article with Paul Mannion over the weekend, and there was nothing about football. It was really just about him, and that, you know, he's been a vegan diet and he studied Chinese and talking about climate change. But it was really interesting, you know. And I think there needs to be more of that from the media around not just Dublin team, but all kind of inter-county setups and inter-county players, because players won't mind talking about that type of stuff. And, you know, if you look at any sport, and, you know, you might get it in, some of the other sports are professional, and, you know, that's the thing. You know, we often compare our lads to professional athletes when we want to, you know. And and with media, like, you've got professional athletes who it's their job to go out and to promote the game and to promote their team and to promote themselves, because they make a living off it. Whereas that's not the case with our games. You know, we have an amateur game, and that's what people value so much about the GAA. So, you know, it is up to the players themselves if they want to do the media, but equally, I think we've a great opportunity to create a kind of a better environment for players to want to do media and to get out there. And like I'll just talk about a few of them. And I was like, Michael Dermot Cawley did some really interesting interviews recently, and he's such an interesting person. Kev Mack, there's so many interesting characters in that team. And if you can stay away from speaking about football, you know, and talk about other things, it's interesting, you know, that kind of way. And
so that's the thing. The Dublin team are told to be guarded about what happens in the Dublin team. You know what I mean?
But if you kept
the conversation away from actual football, like, you know.
But that's the same with any like player, because they'll give you small bits, but they're not going to give you any kind of inside knowledge that people don't already know, you know. And that's the same if you're talking to any sports star, you know. It's the same even if you talk some guys, maybe if you're talking interviewing rugby lads or soccer lads, they might be better at giving you some kind of spin on things. But it's when you get into speaking about, maybe if you're speaking about things that happened in the past or, you know, historical games, or they'll open up a bit. But if you speak about other aspects of the game, you know, you might get more interesting conversations.
I find the rugby lads a lot more comfortable talking about tactics and stuff without being worried about saying the wrong thing. You know, they seem to be more comfortable in their own skin, and GA players in general. Rory Grugan was a notable exception with me this year, who just got into a nice chat about, you know, tactics in the current game. And their tactics and their mistakes they made. And I don't think he gave too much away. He just said, which I think was obvious to people who would be watching anyway. I think there is that whole historical attitude that they'll put that up in the dressing room wall. Do you know that kind of attitude? And players are so worried about being the one that says something that will go up in the other team's dressing room wall. And I've never seen anything go up in a dressing room wall that any team I've been involved in.
But I think it's a national thing. If you look at like sports like in Australia, like they share everything, you know, pretty much. It's just a cultural thing over there that, you know, they share the GPS data, they share, you know, a lot of insights into the dressing room, which I always find really interesting. But they don't share everything, but they give you insights. And similar with like the Hard Knocks, you know, documentaries that the NFL do, like they let you in to a certain extent, but they don't give you everything. And I just think that, you know that's just probably over here, you know, with the GAA, you know, we probably are a little bit guarded overall about it, but because it's important that guys are doing media, I always feel. And the promotion of our games, we have a brilliant game, you know, brilliant games, and I think that it's important that we are promoting it, because it has an impact then on the next generation coming through. And you know, it impacts on, you know, your clubs, and you've got role models there that they can look up to, rather than maybe looking up to you know, premiership stars who are couldn't be further in many ways, not all the cases, but from reality, with regards to kind of the money that they're earning and stuff. But our role models are, you know, in their club, they're working, and they're playing the game. And I think that it's there's something tangible and real about it, that, you know, getting them out into the media, creating a safer environment for them, or a more kind of understanding environments from that perspective would be helpful.
Yeah, okay. Because I know when Jim came in, I think he did put in structures in place regarding the media, though. Like, he has McCormack in there and he controls kind of, or maybe you have to run it past him or whatever. So I think maybe Jim thought the perception before that was a little bit, he probably knows that because Dublin are so high profile, little things can become big things, and he likes to control that. Would that be fair? And, you know, whatever system he has in there, that's McCormack's kind of job.
I just think that it's just about like players playing, and you know, and trying to take away, you know, as many distractions or potential distractions as you can, so that they can focus on performance. And that's always what it's been about, and you know, and that's what it should be about, is performance. But at the same time, like, you know, I do value, like, I'd be a hypocrite if I didn't say that, you know, the media is important, because it is. And like, I would have been involved in, you know, and with IDAS, with AIB and things like that, whereby there was a lot of media engagements, and you know, I always felt comfortable in the media as a result of that. And you know, and I always kind of probably, it trusted the media a little bit, you know, because I was never really, they never, anything I said, if I said it, most of the time I said it, but they can sometimes twist your words, and you know that. But I suppose the more, you know, if you can get a safer environment for players to get out, it'll help.
Well, that's the thing, and this is almost, we're not going to get into any GPA talk now, we don't have time, we're nearly finished, we'll get you in again for that. But like, the thing about media managers is they'll put a blanket ban across all 30 players, where there could be 5 or 6 players would love to do it, there could be another 20 that wouldn't do it even if he wasn't there, they just don't want to do it. But to put the blanket ban across 30 doesn't seem, you know, doesn't seem to be treating players like adults. That's kind of the way I would look at it.
I don't know, maybe some kinds. The blanket ban was probably never the case in Dublin, really. Like, you know, it was about kind of some players just don't want to do it. You're spot on there. But if players wanted to do it, they'd, like, you know, 9 times out of 10 they'd be able to do it. And so I think, you know, it is important, and I can't stress that enough, like the importance of having, you know, a good presence of players in the media. But equally, you can't stress enough the fact that they are amateur athletes and it's their choice.
Yeah. Oh, tell me about it. I'm keeping the head down is the answer I get off a lot of lads around the country. But look, that's the kind of attitude.
And I was the same. Like the fact that you would ask me many times to come in, and that's why I actually nearly felt, you know, that I should come into you, because you're obviously promoting our games, which are podcasts, and you know, you've got your views on things. I don't always agree with them, but at the same time, it's continuous promotion of our games, and that's what's, you know, important. Yeah. For the GAA.
Well, maybe he didn't ban you, but Shep has me banned from all Dublin players. So, like, I mean, even if you wanted to come in, you wouldn't have been allowed. Come here. Finally, I want to talk to you quickly about your professional evolution, because you started off as an apprentice plumber, yeah, back when you started playing, and now you're CEO of the GPA. So, like, I mean, that's been some journey for you. Left the plumbing, went back, and now I appreciate I've had loads of different jobs that came and went until you find something that you love.
Yeah.
So then went back to DCU, then went into recruitment, and now
teaching first. Just throw that
teaching
in there.
First, right? So there's been loads.
Well, I've always been kind of, I suppose, when, and I put a lot of it down to intercounty football, and I put a lot of it down to the GPA itself for supporting me. I know you've been the same over the course of the years, getting that support, but because, you know, probably wasn't available to me when I just finished school. When I came into the panel with Dublin, then, you know, opportunities started to open up, and you're getting scholarships to go back to college, you're getting grants, and that make it feasible, you know. And I remember looking around the dressing room, and a lot of lads all had degrees, and I said, I want a degree. I went back to do a degree, and, you know, I was probably thinking, okay, what degree can I do now that'll let me play football during the summer? I was teaching. And that went, once I probably realised then when I was teaching that it wasn't, you know, what I wanted to do long term. But since then, it's kind of been kind of progressive and kind of all similar enough, whereby I was in HR in Aer Lingus. I went into a kind of HR role. Well, it was in recruitment, but it's more of a commercial side of HR. And now, you know, I'm obviously in a role that was probably mainstay throughout all of it, where I was on the board of the GPA for 7 years, and then I'm obviously have to go in full time now, and, you know, and it's very people centric as well as the HR. So, you know, yeah, there has been kind of you know, some changes, but I think that's, you know, it's just because I've always tried to take myself out of my comfort zone and learn a bit more, you know.
Yeah, no, listen, you've done well, because, like, I mean, especially when you're involved with Intercounty and you're involved in winning All-Irelands, and it can be very easy to become absolutely obsessed with that. Like, I was obsessed with playing with Laois to the point that I worked in a finance job for 7 years that I hated, but I had no motivation to deal with that because this was great kind of part of my life, and I was just so obsessed with it. And then when you're not playing well in football, your life is absolutely in turmoil, because your professional life you hate, and yeah, then the thing that you love to distract yourself from that is not going well, so you don't have any rounded kind of life at all. It's all your eggs are in the football basket. So, like, I mean, I suppose you've been able to keep changing things at the same time as being in a really high performance All-Ireland winning team.
I think that's, like, a lot of lads in the Dublin setup at the moment, they're the same. They've all got this balance whereby, like, they have a career and they're focused on it, and they also have their career. Like, you know, the average now is 31 hours after the ESR report last year highlighted that 31 hours is the average number that's been put in by players, and it's like a dual career. You're living two lives, but you have to find and strike that balance, because, you know, the many players who retire, like, I've retired now, but I know that I have something that I have to focus on, and my void is going to be filled very, very easily with my job, my club football, bit of golf and life at home, and the other things that you probably couldn't enjoy. Whereas if you do finish up playing and you have no career off the pitch, or you have a career that you don't enjoy and he has no aspirations for growth, well, then that's what leads then to players having mental health issues, falling into addictions, and there's a spiralling effect then. So, you know, I'm a big advocate of players while they're in their career, ensuring that they're progressing. And it doesn't have to be like, you know, everything is being put into their career off the pitch, but you have to focus on it. And that's why I also see the benefit of media too, whereby you can use the media to help help progress your career off the field as well.
Yeah.
So that,
show your personality, you know.
Exactly. Yeah.
Which is probably important. Listen, I've taken up enough of your time, and now you have to get back out to Santry there.
Yeah.
For work. So thanks very much for coming in.
Thanks, Willie. Yeah.
And we'll be back tomorrow with a preview podcast as usual. So we'll talk to you then. Good luck.
I'm not finished yet. It took me a long time to get here.
Both players have spoken with each other, and they regret what happened. They've had a frank discussion with each other, and they're both of them are keen to now focus on getting back their county jerseys.
That these fellas will get such a shell shock next Saturday evening that we'll put them back in their asses for 10 years.
The GA Hour is sponsored by Paddy Power. For exclusive content from their GA ambassadors and other high-profile contributors, check out news.paddypower.com.